New from KTEL Records, 22 explosive hits from Leonard Cohen and the Sunshine Band.
Well, my friends are gone, and my head is gray. I ache in the places where I used to play, and I'm crazy for love.
Yes, if you think Leonard Cohen is too gloomy, you haven't heard this KTEL Powerhouse Collection.
I stepped into an avalanche. It covered up my soul.
The happy side of Leonard Cohen in this blockbuster KTEL release. Order now before he sues us.
If you want a lover, I'll do anything you ask me to.
Also from KTEL, The Nose. Three dynamite panelists. Manfred Mann, Olivia Newton-Papoulos, and David Soul. And now he's known as Casey Kasem for Depressives, Colin McEnroe.
That's right. These three panelists were playing together in a garage band in Montreal. Now they have a number one talk show. The name of that band, when we get back. All right, so we are going to be talking. First of all, mad props to Jonathan McPence, who put that intro together on the scantest instructions from me. So that was very impressive. All right, we're going to be talking about Leonard Cohen today. We're also going to be talking about how to describe this. I mean, you sort of think that the whole speculation about the personality of Donald Trump load is pretty tapped out. But you would be wrong. You would be wrong. Well, we happened upon some audio tapes this week that, at least to some of us, struck us as kind of the Orson Welles take on this guy, the Orson Welles take that we've been waiting for. Anyway, that is to come. But first of all, let me tell you who's here. Well, the part of David Soul is, in fact, played by Bill Curry today. He is himself and many other people besides. And he claims he's making his debut on The Nose. We don't think that's entirely true, but it might be true. Irene Papoulos, teaches writing at Trinity College, and Brian Francis Slattery is arts editor for the New Haven Independent, a producer at WNHH Radio, a musician, a novelist, lots of other stuff as well. So we're going to begin with Leonard Cohen's new release, You Want It Darker. He's 82 years old. Let's begin, before we say a word, let's play a little bit of the title track, You Want It Darker.
If you are the dealer, I'm out of the game. If you are the healer, means I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker, we kill the flame. Magnified, sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the help that never came. You want it darker. Hey, nay, hey, nay, nay. I'm ready, my lord.
All right. That, by the way, he's saying hineni, hineni, which is the Hebrew word meaning basically here I am, and with a little bit of subtext of at your service. It's kind of – well, it's what Abraham says when God calls to him. At first, it's what Moses says when the burning bush begins to communicate with him.
And it's how you answer the phone.
I'm going to start doing that, actually, hineni, hineni. It's like better. Didn't Alexander Graham Bell say ahoy?
Isn't ahoy, that ahoy.
Ahoy.
Yeah.
Ahoy,
yeah. It's different, but go ahead.
Things you learn from watching The Simpsons.
That's right, because that's what Mr. Burns says.
How Mr. Burns answers the phone.
Mr. Burns answers the phone. Ahoy, ahoy, yeah.
Ahoy, ahoy.
So anyway, we're already getting sidetracked here. We haven't even said a word about Leonard Cohen. So, Brian, I'm going to start with you. You're the musician among us. I mean, it's – first of all, I this is a beautifully, beautifully produced album to my ears.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that it's musically a huge departure for Leonard. It's the Leonard we know.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, for musicians, one of the – it's not exactly a criticism as much of an observation that, like, Leonard Cohen's music can often be, like, sort of cheesy and maybe a little boring. But it's – like, as in the background music.
Wow.
that it's you know that it's sort of like a you know it's kind of it's more like a backdrop for the lyrics, you know, and it's it seems to be a pretty like obvious intention of his to be like, this is, you know, I'm a lyricist, which, you know, he says a lot, you know, especially when someone talks about his music, he says, you know, I'm just a poet. And the lyrics are wonderful and obviously worth listening to. And on this album in particular, I think that like his voice is really in front of the music. You know, to the point where I was listening to it in my car on the way up here, and I could barely hear the music sometimes, you know, over the road noise, you know. And then meanwhile, his voice is, you know, crystal clear. But on this album, what's, you know, it's nice to not hear a lot of sort of, you know, out of the box synthesizer noises, and instead some like really, really thoughtful and like really tasteful in a good way arrangements of these things. You know, like he's got a couple of players behind him who obviously really know what they're doing and are really good at not overplaying, you know, so that the texture has some really nice sort of like subtle shifts to it that, you know, keep me going for sure. You know, even apart from the lyrics.
So, Irene, Leonard Cohen kind of arrives to us here at the age of 82 and in lots of different guises and lots of different forms. I mean, there is this guy who is almost strictly a poet in some ways, but there's also a guy who writes songs. And then there's also a guy that we've sort of watched in various ways. Right now, he's arriving on the heels of a very lengthy David Remnick profile in The New Yorker. Terry Gross just re-aired a really fascinating conversation with him on Fresh Air. So there's this guy, too. I mean, maybe more than a lot of musicians, including, I mean, people like Bob Dylan, who, you know, kind of consciously remains kind of inscrutable. And then, you know, lots of other musicians like Paul Simon, who, I mean, we don't even – we know a lot about this guy is what I'm trying to say.
We know a lot about him. Yeah. Well,
but do we know him?
But do we know him? I don't – yeah. I mean, it just – in response to what Brian said, I feel like the word cheesy is so it just seems so offensive to, you know, and I can see why somebody would see it as him as cheesy, but at the
same
time.
Have you heard the synthesizer noises from some of the albums in the 80s, especially?
I just don't think it's cheesy at all, you know, but that it's because of, I feel like it's probably, if I just heard it out of the blue now and I never heard of Leonard Cohen, mm-hmm. I might be able to understand what you said. But in this, listening to this one, I just felt like those background voices are so great and beautiful. And I always had a fantasy, like, if only I could be a backup singer for Leonard Cohen, that would be like my dream. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I, you know, he when I was in high school, I got that album Songs from a Room, and I just it just you know, and it was interesting because I don't have the actual record anymore. I haven't had it for probably decades. And I remembered it as a picture. So I started to think about it. And I remembered the picture as the white room. And I remembered it as a woman lying in a naked with a sheet around her. And then I looked up the album and I realized, no, she's not lying in a bed. She's sitting at a desk with a towel around
her. That was
her.
You.
And it was right. So that was the kind of that was the kind of fantasy that I remembered him evoking in me, like just this sort of like, you're in Greece, you're having this like amazing love affair, you know, there's all these, this music and depth and spirituality / sexuality. And so that person, the seeds of that were planted in me in terms about Leonard Cohen make me just horrified at the thought of him being cheesy. But, you know, I just feel like that's so much a part. So for me, that's so much a part of him more than who he actually may be as a person.
Hmm. Well, I know Bill is itching to get in here, although I will say I kind of know what Brian is saying about that, too. And I was actually very interested in the Remnick profile, where in the middle of the profile, Bob Dylan, who never talks very much about anything or anybody, he won't even answer phone calls from people giving him Nobel Prizes, goes into this lengthy, you know, disquisition about not just about the lyrics and status of Leonard Cohen, but about his music, and says his music's kind of underrated and it's better than people realize. And he explains it in ways that I don't entirely understand. It did remind me of, because I don't particularly like Leonard Cohen's music, it did remind me of what Mark Twain said about Wagner, which is his music isn't as bad as it sounds. But that's just me. All right, Bill, take over. Bill has been like on a 25-year project to convert me to Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, and I just gave up. You'll be relieved to know those last few moments got you off the hook. Let me say, first of all, I actually once had a chance to meet Leonard Cohen, and I passed up on it. This was many, many years ago. And I knew him only through Judy Collins, and I knew that he'd done the some of the track to a movie I was in love with called McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which you may remember. And but I didn't really, you know, it was sort of a folky thing. As I hadn't been listening. And then much later in life, 15 years ago, I haven't been on you for 25 years. I haven't been on Leonard for 25 years. I was listening to a wonderful K.D. Lang album called The Hymns to the 49th Parallel, in which she does Bird and a Wire. It's all Canadian composers, and she does Bird and a Wire and Hallelujah. And it just blew me away, and I got the essential Leonard Cohen and then all of it, and I became president and recording secretary of the Farmington chapter of Deadheads for Leonard Cohen. And I know it gets a little boring sometimes, but I think this is our greatest living lyricist. I don't have any doubt about that. And I would just say to Brian, I you know, Brian's a musician, and I've just spent my life parsing language, so naturally I would come to that part of it first and second. But part of the reason for the cheesy reputation that came up is that Leonard used the word cheesy a lot, and sometimes in a sort of self-deprecating way. And I'm reminded of Keith Richard taking guitar licks and putting them on cheap recorders and then onto the as he did on Street Fighting Man and Jumping Jack Flash, because he wanted it that way. Leonard going into a tourist shop in Times Square and getting a cheap little recorder on a kind of synthesizer sound because he wanted it that way. And when I listen to Tower of Song and I'm Your Man and some of the stuff from – I don't mean the Phil Spector stuff, but some of that stuff that was clearly Leonard's, it sounds great to me. And now, again, I have a kind of art's greatest hits knowledge of music, so I'm not someone to speak
well,
to
that. I mean, I'm Your Man is a perfect album for that, because I have that thing where it has both my favorite – of his songs and my least favorite of his songs on it, depending on whether I think the synth noises work, quote-unquote.
See, and that's just not how I'd approach it. I just want to say one other thing, and that is that to what Colin was saying, this guy's 82 years old. I know this isn't a show about gerontology, but we've had a...
Sometimes it feels that way.
Yeah, that's right. Only when I'm here. But there is this thing that's going on here in which, you know, you've seen Paul Simon come out with a very good album. Van Morrison has a great album. Which, again, sort of what Brian said, people are saying, it just sounds like all the other Van Morrison, to which I say, great.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, and Dylan, of course, is still producing. Stephen Sondheim, who hasn't had a hit in 25 years, may have another show coming out. I don't know of a single composer of any era or genre who has composed at this high a quality and at this pace so late in life. Is there anybody else who ever made music this good this often at the age of 82? He's had three great albums since he was 78. It's really kind of extraordinary. The last thing I'll just say is that I'd love one thing about Dylan and Simon and Leonard. All have been all their lives interested in different mixes of the political, the personal, and especially the romantic and the spiritual. And Leonard's, when they Leonard the album with The Future and First We Take Manhattan and Democracy, and Everybody Knows. They're some of the most powerful political – we don't think of them that way. Some of the most powerful political songs. And on that same album was the most beautiful spiritual song I think he ever wrote, called The Anthem. Forget Your Perfect Offering. Let the bells that still can ring. There's a crack in everything. That's
all right.
I'm
going to break in just because we're on a tough fundraising clock here, and I want to get a little bit more of the music on the air. This is probably the song that we all have different songs that we like the best. This is a song called On the Level. We're going to pick it up with the second verse.
Now I'm living in this temple where they tell you what to do. I'm old and I've had to settle on a different point of view. I was fighting with temptation, but I didn't want to win. A man like me don't like to see temptation cave it in. Your crazy fragrance all around, your secrets in my view. My loss was same found, my doom. It on the level. When I walked away from you, walked away. I turned my back on the devil. Turned my back.
He turned his back on the angel too. So Irene, he's obviously writing about you, lying under that white sheet, waiting for him. I guess, you know, one of the things that I have a question about, I love Leonard Cohen, the concept. Like, I really love Leonard Cohen, the concept.
This song? How about this song?
I like this song a lot. Yeah. I like this song a lot. And my whole thing is, like, after three songs, I'm done. It doesn't matter what three songs are, I'm done. But I love Leonard Cohen, the concept. I like reading about him. I like the person I read about when I'm reading about him. I like listening to him talk on Fresh Air. I haven't seen the documentary, I'm Your Man, but I bet you I'll like that too. But one question that I have for people who really do like him is, so much of this, as Bill has suggested, is really about spirituality and spiritual quest. And you know, I mean, you read the Remnick profile, and this guy spent just huge chunks of his life engaged in religious questions. And I sort of wonder about, like, the non-faith community. like I get all this, you know. But I sort of, like, I don't know. Do people – I feel like he's making faith fashionable, which I'm all in favor of.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think – and it's also the non-faith community also has something, some relationship to – some kind of ineffable feeling that he provides for us, you know, that's like it's sort of this mysterious thing. It's not connected to a religion. He's careful to say he's not a – he said, you know
– You feel like he's leaving the light on for you?
He's leaving the light on for us. Yeah. And that's I think, a huge part of his appeal, just this sense of some kind of connection to something that's, you know, potentially it's human, but it's not what we usually talk about in our daily life, but it's transcendent, and he's going to take us there. That's why I sort of feel like, don't tell me about your life. I just want you to take me there, you know, somehow.
All right. I'm going to play a little bit of Brian's favorite song, current, at least was last time we checked in with Brian. This is called Treaty.
Treaty is really good.
I've seen you change the water and the wine. I've seen you change it back to water, too. I sit at your table every night. I try, but I just don't get high with you. I wish there was a treaty we could sign. I do not care who takes this bloody hill. I'm angry and I'm tired all the time. I wish there was a treaty. I wish there was a treaty between your love and mine.
All right, Slattery, take over here. Why is this your favorite song on this CD?
Part of it is a lot of it actually is because of what Bob Dylan talks about in the New Yorker article, that the music underneath this is really, really cool. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's got like it's got an awful lot of sort of you know, there's a bit of sort of like hymn gospel kind of stuff going on, just enough jazz to make it interesting. And I also just I think this is my favorite set of lyrics on this album, and I think this album has a lot of really strong lyrics, but this one is the one that really gets to me. I like the whole "I do not care who takes this bloody hill," mm-hmm. and how every it seems to me that in this particular song, virtually every line can be read in two ways,
yes.
possibly more than that, and so it rewards you for listening closely.
Right, Bill. You know. I think you would agree about that too. That could be. This is one of those Leonard Cohen songs. It could be about a relationship. Could be about his place in the cosmos. And
yeah. Or all of the above.
It
right?
has to be about. First of all, in terms of the of a relationship with a woman and a relationship with God, it's got to be both. It just sort of drips out of every line. And let me just say, you know, my feelings were a little hurt when you interrupted me while I was reciting the refrain to Anthem. But then when you said you couldn't listen to more than two Leonard Cohen songs in a row, I felt better. And I just want to go back to that point in that it came out at a time when he's always on three different levels. In the same album which he did Democracy, you know, and he's talking about the sorrow in the street and the holy places where the races meet and the homicidal bitching that goes down out of your kitchen, he's writing Anthem. And it kind of is something for our moment. He has this tempered but insistent hope. And it really is expressed in the spiritual songs alongside of a much darker social view, and often a darker view of himself, a very honest and again, in this age of propaganda, here's this person really trying to plumb the depths of his own soul to the best of his ability and lay it out there. And at the end of his life, in these last few albums, there's almost nothing political. Now it is almost – and there's almost nothing sensuous in all the sensuality and other stuff. Now it's really just focused on that sort of last stage, self-recognition and larger question.
All right. For more of Bill Curry talking about Leonard Cohen, we'll have like a 90-minute SoundCloud thing we'll put up. But right now, we have to take a break. And there's going to be some people asking you to support public radio. It's the last day of the drive. And I think they have gifties and nice things to give you, too. So if you really like the kind of radio that we do here and like shows like The Nose, do the right thing. All right. So I don't forget, on Thursday of this coming week, November 3rd at 3 p.m. at Theater Works, Richard Dreyfuss and I are going to sit on the stage of the play Relativity, in which he's playing Einstein, and we are going to talk. And you can join us in the audience. Tickets are $20. They support WNPR and Theater Works. You call the Theater Works box office to get those tickets. I think I understand. My sense is he really wants to talk about the election, too. So we are going to, therefore, we're going to do the show. We're going to turn it around really fast. It'll be The Nose next Friday. Just The Nose will just be me and Richard Dreyfuss. So that'll be on the 4th. But if you want to see the thing live anyway, there are tickets available, 3 p.m. All right. So we're moving on. This next segment is either to the eternal blame or eternal credit of Irene Papoulos. Because, you know, one thing we've been struggling with is like we just kind of don't want to talk about politics and the election on The Nose, although it so overwhelms the culture these days. Like no election ever has, that it's very hard to keep it out one way or another. But, you know, we're always kind of trying to build that wall, as they say. But so she was emailing us about this this podcast, The Run-Up, which is like maybe the only political podcast I haven't been listening to. And the way that these tapes that have surfaced, you've seen them in The New York Times, written about in The New York Times. The Run-Up is a New York Times podcast. They're Donald Trump talking a few years ago about himself to a biographer, Michael D'Antonio, and they're talking. You hear him. Well, actually, rather than me describe it, we're going to play one. This is about the first time he saw his name in print.
I'll never forget the first time I ever saw my name in print was in a little paper up in that area of New York, because I had had three singles and a home run. Huh. So the headline was Trump wins game for NEMA. And I said, I love it.
You love that?
Yeah, I loved it. It was the first time I was ever in a newspaper. You know, I was a young kid, right? I was probably a sophomore in high school. Seeing my name in print felt good.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Very interesting.
I think everybody has that experience if they let themselves be honest about it. Like if,
Well, most people aren't in print, though. Don't forget how many people are in print. Yeah, I think people would like it, but who's in print?
Right.
Hmm. Nobody's in print. I mean,
you get that little thing, listed in the honor roll or something.
But in your world,
but basically, you're not in print because right. People aren't going to write. Even in look, this was just a special thing where I had a lot of hits and a lot of stuff, right? But even then, you know, you're not going to be in print unless you did that. So very few people are in print.
Very few people are in print, Irene. I think that's one message we can get very clearly here. So the two people that you hear talking, you hear Donald Trump here, but then the analysis of these tapes are done by this guy D'Antonio, who's working on this biography of Trump, and Michael Barbaro, who's from The New York Times and is the host of this podcast. I had to keep reminding myself all the way through that neither one of them is a therapist because they both talk like therapists.
Yeah.
Brian isn't having it either. Brian's not feeling that, but we'll come to that in a second. There's so much there, just including this kind of – you can hear D'Antonio break in and go, well, you know, people get in print for the honor roll. This is like he's a high school kid who got four hits in a baseball game, and he's insisting that it's this completely sui generis experience that nobody could possibly identify with because nobody knows what it's like to be in print.
Yeah. Even if you're in the honor roll, that's pretty exciting if you're in high school, but no, it doesn't count. Yeah, well, speaking of – yeah, so they're not psychologists, but they just are great psychologists in terms of how they analyze him. And I just love the way D'Antonio is saying, like, yeah, you know, like sort of to encourage him on the tape to go along. And then, you know, but then he gives us – it's just such a great little window into his whole experience of the tape, being on the tape, and then talking about what he was really thinking or what he was really putting together about that. I just think it's a fantastic way of I mean, Trump has you know, in spite of all the political side we're not really talking about, he has just provided a very, very interesting figure. He is a very interesting figure for psychoanalysis and just thinking about his personality type, his kind of person, his kind of man, what makes him tick, you know, and that I think that helps us think about ourselves too, by, you know, to think about him, like, why is he, I mean, yes, he's unique, but he also, there are threads of him everywhere.
So these tapes, they include Trump talking about his childhood, about his father, about his brother who died young from a drinking problem. They then go on to include very strange little anecdotes about Arsenio Hall and about a lounge singer whom Trump tried to discover. We may be able to share that one with you a little bit more as we go along. They also include other people talking about Trump, including Ivana telling this kind of amazing ski slope story, which you may have seen in the New York Times. But yes, all of it, Brian, is sort of played out, at least on this podcast, in this very un-team kind of sound. The tapes sound very un-team, and then this slightly hushed conversation between these two men has a little bit of the cloistered feeling of the therapy chamber. And you just weren't feeling it, babe.
Yeah, not really. I think that part of it is that, you know, I sort of felt this gets into like what podcasts can do, right, that other things can't do. And one of them is that because we haven't really decided what podcasts are yet, you are allowed to take recordings and put them on a couch in a therapy session in a way that, like, if you're going to write a newspaper article, you wouldn't be able to do it. And there are very few other media. I can't think of anything right now exactly. Even radio, it would be sort of weird to do a segment, you know, on radio like that. But I think that, you know, for me, this was like the first time I honestly kind of felt bad for the guy, because I thought, like, you're saying an awful lot of things about his personality and not really giving him a chance to respond. Like, this is one of the few times where I actually want to hear what Trump would say about the way that the two guys on the podcast.
You think the interview was rigged? is that what you're telling us, Brian? Wow. Let me just wrap my mind around that.
But, Brian, I do feel like the very nature of the tapes that we're listening to is sort of Trump's response, right? I mean, he's constantly being challenged in the gentlest possible way by D'Antonio, and then kind of usually that whole thing, he has like tends to have a word that he repeats over and over again, whether it's a phrase like in print or acclimated. I mean, he's sort of telling you what his take. I mean, his take on himself is the only thing he really has, as opposed to some kind of pure declaration of self.
Yeah, though if we're gonna do the therapy thing, though, doesn't the person on the couch get a chance to respond when the therapist says something about them?
No, that's debating.
Okay, no, actually, I think is the answer. But it sounds to me to differ with Brian again. It sounds to me as if, I mean, really, what you're saying is that at each time, D'Antonio should step in and say, "Now, would you like to take a moment to explain to us why that doesn't mean what it seems to?" Because, you know, it's basically his own words. I was touched. You know, I was telling you about the – I had this wonderful friend of mine who's a Buddhist chef, Victor, and we were talking about Trump. And he he from the beginning has seen Trump suffering. Mm-hmm. And he sees this horrible, needy, angry, undeveloped, frozen personality. And he had said this to me in response. I had said, you know, one of the great things about Trump is that he's provided us this tableau of almost everything that's wrong. He's the anti-Gandhi who modeled the character development that India needed, and he's the one who models everything that's wrong with us. And now we'll at least have this illustrated lesson. And he said, yes, and think of how he suffered to become that, which was such an insight for me. I'm still trying to get around it. But it came home to me. I agree with – I mean, this makes for very compelling listening, this podcast. And I didn't know about it either, so thank you. But that moment, especially when he's talking about the newspapers that you just ran, when he's talking about seeing his face in the newspaper, all I could think of was Narcissus looking into the pond for the first time. Like, that could be the moment in which you became this just completely solipsistic and pathetic and hollowed out figure. So, you know, I also thought it was really interesting in terms of watching him in this election. One of the things that D'Antonio, this is my phrase, but what he was saying was that he's not only is he not capable of introspection, he's not capable of retrospection. You know, he barely has a memory for his own misdeeds because he can't bear the thought of them. And he literally says that two or three times in the interview. And it just sort of we've spent every week for the last few months wondering, how could he do that again? You know, you did that again. And it's, oh, right, he can't bear to even stop to learn from a lesson, which is just the 1,000th reason he shouldn't be president.
He does say at one point, I like the future. I like the future, which, of course, reminds me of Don Draper. Only forward. Only go forward. from Mad Men. Right. But he says, oh, of course, I learned from the past. But, you know, I like to think about the future. So he does throw that out for a second. Of course, I learned from the past. But it's not true. We know it's not true. I think at least, you know, we don't have to be that good of a therapist to know that that's not true, that he is incapable of learning regret or expressing regret or really learning from the past, which is a fascinating quality that a lot of people have.
I mean, I don't know how, you know, how confessional I would be to some guy that I didn't know that well writing a biography on me. But I mean, what struck me, Irene, was how much of the past he's essentially divorced from and has digested into kind of a secondary experience. I mean, it's even there in that little baseball clip. Most of us men, despite what these two guys on the podcast would say, most of us men do remember the home run that we hit, if we ever hit one, you know, in a significant game. We remember that very keenly. We don't necessarily remember the little article that somebody did in some jerkwater newspaper about it afterwards, but we remember that moment very much. But so much of what Trump says in these tapes is, rather than any kind of direct sense of, I mean, he talks about the death of his brother Fred, you know, but in a way he just kind of turns it into a lesson. He goes, so when people ask me about that, I say, well, watch out for the drinking, you know, as opposed to, and I was incredibly sad. The person I was maybe in some ways closest to in the world was gone. Nothing like – there's never anything like that. There's always a story about sort of how something plays out as a public lesson or what his takeaway was from that.
Yeah, and I think that's why Bill's friend Victor felt like he was – like there's something sad about that, because there is. Mm-hmm. Not to be able to say, I felt really upset or I felt really proud of myself when I hit that thing. It's only how do other people see it or, you know, what does it look like? And so D'Antonio develops this whole idea that Trump is living a fantasy, like a five-year-old at one point, he says, a five-year-old's fantasy of a life, you know, like what a billionaire should be like, thrown in with some Hugh Hefner references or something, I think he says, you know. And so it's like the idea that he develops in the podcast is, or the, in the, you know, in talking about the tapes, is that, yeah, there's no human vulnerability whatsoever. And even though, and he's done so much damage, to, you know, in so many ways, but the internal experience of that is in some way to be pitied.
Just 2 points. One of which is that we've had all these revelations in the campaign of Trump's taxes and the Hollywood access tapes and now this profile and Hillary's speeches and then the WikiLeaks of her staff memos. And each time each one hits like at least a little bit of a bomb, and each time I'm thinking, well, yeah, but I knew that, you know. And you know, there's nothing. I didn't learn anything from his tax returns. He's a conniving, selfish guy who's never given a charity, doesn't pay his taxes, and stiffs his contractors. Hillary is a master of pay-to-play politics. And as I listened to this, I thought I could tell that story the time I spent an hour with Trump in his apartment, and that was 20 years ago. But I came away I left thinking this guy's insane. And that, you know, but my first, I spent 1 hour with him, and we laughed all the way back home. My finance chair, Bobby Simons, and I, about what a nutball the guy was.
Well, you can definitely identify with the uncomfortable laughter on the tapes.
Yes.
You know, where you just think,
yes,
like, how do I even respond to what this man is saying?
And,
you know,
and so it's with all these late campaign revelations have only told us things if we looked into our own hearts, we knew the moment he was coming down that escalator in the Trump Tower, we knew all this about him.
The moment he was a birther.
You know, this is a fraud, a fascist, and a deeply emotionally unstable man, and he's almost the president.
See, I feel like that there is stuff in here that I didn't know or didn't understand, and I'm still processing. And I feel like I am hearing something that I don't typically hear. I'm gonna play this other thing. This is a story that he tells on the second of these two interlinked podcasts. I think it's a story that most take place in maybe the early 90s. It's about some kind of big awards dinner where Trump was getting an award. He probably he was being offered all kinds of possible entertainers to perform at this. But he found this lounge singer who he thought was really good, who he thought he could break. He could really do something great for this guy. So over the objections of Steve Ross, over the objections of Steve Ross, who was this this entertainment titan who was planning this whole thing and would supply him with anybody he wanted, Trump insisted on this lounge singer.
I told the guy, I said, "You have got tonight a chance to be a star." He said, "Do a great job." So he's driving up, and he was some place down in New Jersey, and he's driving to the event for rehearsal, and he's in an automobile accident. And he's injured and gets taken to the hospital, but he's badly injured, you know, meaning he's in the hospital for 2-3 days. Not death, but he was hurt bad enough that he... So he goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, our performer didn't make it tonight." And I just heard that. I'm sitting there saying, "Will you hear this guy?" And they say, "Kim." Okay, so that was that. So they didn't have the performance. And I said, "That's why he's a lounge act." Now, I'm not blaming injury. I'm just saying, that's fate. Why he's a lounge
There's
act.
There's a fate part of this.
Not even fate. He was meant to be a lounge act. For whatever reason. I mean, he was in the hospital. Okay, I didn't say, "Oh, you should have shown up and you were in the hospital." The guy didn't show up. I said, "Steve, he's a lounge act. He always will be a lounge act. That's the way it is."
So obviously, as Woody Allen would say, interesting distinction. It's not fate, but he was meant to be a lounge act.
Yeah,
but there's something that he's trying to tell us there, Brian, about his vision of the world, about how the world works, that I've sort of never heard it expressed quite that way before.
Yeah, and apparently it doesn't include the name of the poor guy either, which is, you know, we'll never
also,
know.
He
right?
was the one that thought he was going to, you know, do great. So,
right.
you know, but the yeah. minute he didn't, it's like, oh, no, you know, he dismisses him.
Right. So you're saying this is essentially a story about this man's failure to fit into Donald Trump's narrative, which thus consigns him to this kind of Dantean fate to always be a lounge singer.
Which is, yeah, exactly. And that's like his brother. Supposedly he really loved his brother, Fred Jr., and then the brother became an alcoholic, and instead of being able to say, "Oh my gosh, it was horrible because I love my brother and he died," he has to say, "Well, he was weak because he was an alcoholic." You know, so he can't admit to the, you know, so to anyone else's vulnerability, including his own.
You know, again, this stuff is interesting. I agree that it's interesting, but there's sort of clues I felt I didn't need. You know, if he were more of a mystery, these would be fascinating clues, except it's kind of all out there. And, you know, if you want to –
I hate to interrupt you, but I've got to go to a break or I'm going to get in trouble. Producers are yelling at me right now. So we're going to take a very quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to do endorsements, and that's going to be about it.
You slipped big time. I heard you. You said your favorite color was green.
So guess what?
All right. Special thanks to Jonathan McPants, who has produced this show. Wolfie's off today. And thanks to everybody else who worked on the show. Katie Tularski has been keeping us on track today. We're going to be back on Monday with a scramble. We're going to be talking to people in the social sciences and personality research about how people's personalities either predict or at least play into the hard choices they make in an election like this. Now it's time to endorse things. It's time to recommend things. Irene Papoulos, I'm going to begin with you.
Speaking of having conversations about personalities, I want to endorse the bar at the Shish Kebab House of Afghanistan. It's such a great place.
Right.
And they have great appetizers, and it's really fun, and it's a great place to go.
And you sit there and have – it's Cafe Society. You have
Cafe Society in there. It really feels like it.
I did not know that. I'm going to go there right away. That's on LaSalle Road in West Hartford.
Yeah. Irene's whole life is like Paris in the 20s. Right. You know, I mean, it's really impressive. So I'm going to just be political in my endorsements. And did you know we have 36 state senators and only 8 of them are women? And it just makes me think of my friend Arlene Avery, who's up running in a really uphill race up in the Summers and East part. And I just want to shout out to my friend Mike D'Amico, who's my state rep, who's like the Tina Turner of politics, knocks on every door. He's probably fine. And an observation that lastly, the Republicans may not win this one, but it's going to be closer and then a big, big fight coming up next
All right.
time.
Big wheel to keep on turning. I'm trying to figure out how Mike D'Amico is Tina Turner. But I'll take your word for it.
it really is for another show. Even I'll admit that.
All right. What have you got? You guys are going really fast here. So you have a cushion here if you need to go along.
Well, since Halloween's around the corner, the thing I want to – so some friends and I have been passing around things that we think are pretty messed up to each other. And one of the things that I've been passing around is this graphic novel called Spiral, which is it's a Japanese I think it was originally – you know, published in little units but is now available in this gigantic book. And it is like really, really unsettling. It's one of those things where, you know – horror fans like to do that sort of, well, it's not that unsettling. Is it that is it as bad as this? Is it as bad as this? But this book really does it. It's one of those things where things get sort of like creepier and creepier and creepier and creepier in a way that's like really quite unique. And if people like that sort of thing, I would totally recommend it.
I'm going to endorse, based on only two episodes so far, the rebooted Prairie Home Companion under Chris Thiele. There were things that Garrison Keillor did that nobody could possibly do. Nobody will ever do them again. It was, as our glass says, a high wire act that no one else could perform. But there were also things that Garrison Keillor did that were getting a little stale. I happen not to like very much this very disposable song that he would write and sing at the beginning of each show. With an actual musician hosting the show, Chris Thiele, formerly of the Punch Brothers, I mean, the show musically has gotten amazing right away. I think Esperanza Spalding is on it this week, which is going to be very interesting. You really have a host who can meld the music there. He's writing a song of the week too, but some of these are like really good songs. So, I mean, he'll never be able to do the stuff that Garrison Keillor did that was uniquely Garrison Keillor, but in all of the ways that you know, that Garrison Keillor was special. Thiele is going to do some other stuff, and I'm very, very hopeful and excited about it. So I would say give this guy a chance.
Does he tell stories?
No, he doesn't do like Tales from Lake Wobegon stories and stuff. But
did you really not know that Tina Turner's the hardest working girl in show business?
Oh, that was the whole idea. Okay. Yeah.
Did you you forgot that? Really?
All right. So she will not be on Prairie Home Companion this week. But, as long as I've got a couple of seconds left here, I'll also say sort of in a similar vein, Trevor Noah just was on Fresh Air. I always enjoy these interviews with Trevor Noah. He's really, really smart and really, really interesting. And I think maybe – and
less
he's
so – he's.
But I think he's – he was also put in a very difficult position. I mean, taking over for Jon Stewart is like taking over for Garrison Keillor, right? I mean, people don't cut you a lot of slack. So go back to The Daily Show and watch it now. He's starting to find his rhythm and his footing a little bit. And so give this guy another chance. He's a really, really interesting guy. So
it took Jon Stewart 4 years.
Right, exactly. All right, we have to go now. People are going to ask you to support public radio. Please do that. Do that. Yeah, you should do that. Do the right thing.
Yeah. You and me talking.